This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Take Bullseye and More with you on the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. Surprising interviews, your favorite podcasts, and now an easy way to listen to your favorite station live. NPR One's ready to make commuting, cleaning the house, or alone time better. Find NPR O-N-E on your app store.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Michael K. Williams had a breakout role on the HBO show The Wire. He played Omar Little, a Baltimore stick-up man. Omar was a really intense and rich character. He was menacing, he robbed drug dealers, he was gay, and he lived by his own strict moral code. Williams played him brilliantly. But when he was cast in the role, he wasn't in the best place personally. He was trying, though.
I put together this real gaudy package and a hit list of 10 people who I was going to send this package to, like the real, the head shout out. My homeboy, his mom's worked for Tiffany's. So I went and got all these Tiffany pens and Tiffany boxes, and I sprayed the tissue with Tiffany cologne, just going all out. And I sent them out for Christmas presents, right? I said, you know what, Mike, it's Christmas. Let it marinate. I said, I watched my clock. It was around January 10th, 14th. I should be getting some calls like, oh, my God, we want to see you. Man, here we are in March. I'm like, yeah, man, I kind of slipped into a darkness. I got a little depressed. That's where I was at when I got a call from Alexa Fogel. Thank God for her. She scoured the streets in New York to find me because apparently she did not see my awesome package.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Michael about what it felt like to be a club kid who got a real gig being a backup dancer.
I felt like a grown-up. I felt like, you know, I felt like, damn, it's really possible to get paid doing something you love. You know, that wasn't a job. That was my first glimpse into my career. You know, who'd have thunk it? Me from Brooklyn, from Flatbush, with a career. That doesn't happen often.
But first, I'll talk with actor and comedian Zach Galifianakis. His character in the FX series Baskets is a downtrodden rodeo clown. He's pretty nasty. Zach says he made it that way for a pretty good reason.
There are people that are mean. Just go walk the streets. They're never represented. We're trying to represent people in this show that aren't represented on TV. They just aren't. It's so funny to me that a protagonist has to be one way. Why can't we stretch out a little bit and at least explore these other avenues?
And I'll play you a rap song about death that makes me want to live. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedian Andy Kindler once called Zach Galifianakis the thinking man's Pauly Shore. It's because Zach has always been deeply committed to dumb jokes, but he always finds a way to make the dumbness his own. Galifianakis, obviously, these days, well-known as a movie star, the one-man wolf pack of the Hangover movies, among other films. He's also the man behind Between Two Ferns, the very uncomfortable talk show deconstruction that boasts among its past guests the president. He co-created and stars in the FX show Baskets. It's in the middle of its second season right now. Baskets is about a sad clown. And when I say a sad clown, I mean literally a sad clown named Chip Baskets, who fails out of French clown school because he doesn't speak French. He comes home to Bakersfield, and in this scene from the show, he's applying for the only clown job he can find at the rodeo.
It says here that you studied clowning at the Clown Frances, Academy de Clown Frances.
That's correct, at the Academy de Clown and Francois.
So, Chip Baskets? Oh, my God. What a name for a clown.
That's my real name. That's my...
Your Basket's a clown now, Pally.
I have another clown name, and I prefer to go by that, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, what's your clown name?
My clown name is Renoir.
What?
Renoir.
Can't have no clown here named Renoir. You're Baskets. Baskets clown. You know how many of you clowns end up in the basket? That's the most perfect clown name I ever heard.
Great.
You're hired.
I am?
Sure. Don't take nothing to get hired around here other than walk in that door right there and tell me you're damn fool enough to want the job.
Thank you very much.
I don't pay enough.
Mm-hmm.
They all quit. You'll quit, too.
I'll take it.
Okay. Care for a cup of coffee before you leave?
No, I'm okay. Thank you.
If I'm remembering correctly, that coffee cup is shaped like a toilet.
Jesse, take the high road. There's very little traffic on there. Yeah, there's a he's drinking from a coffee mug in the shape of a toilet.
So, one of the things that you've always loved doing, and it's kind of an interesting thing to be really into for a guy who made his name as a stand-up comic who mostly sat behind a piano, is just big, stupid pratfalls.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you conceived of this clown character partly because you just wanted to do things where you, like, ran into stuff and fell.
I would have done that regardless of whatever character. because it's really fun to do. No, the rodeo clown aspect just kind of came as kind of a weird juxtaposition in my head of a guy that was bitter in his mind and then where he had to, you know, externally be happy for his work made me laugh. But the physical comedy in it, it's just something that I'm kind of obsessed with right now is physical comedy. And it's not very popular anymore. I think that's why I wanted to do it.
Well, I think everybody wants to do a movie that has a lot of improvised punchlines, which means you have to have a lot of kind of setups and you give a bunch of punchlines while you're in front of the camera. And you can't – it's very difficult to improvise a good fall because you have to not hurt yourself really badly.
My hips are they've been out of whack for a few months because of this show. And I don't do the heavy lifting. There's a gentleman named Hayden Dalton that does most of the heavy lifting. But sometimes for the camera, you just have to do it. But I'm too old. I'm too old to be doing it at my age.
The world is very cruel to Chip Baskets, the main character of Baskets. He is no peach himself. He's kind of a jerk to everyone around him, too.
Mm-hmm.
What did you like when you were putting together this show? Why did you think, I want to play a guy who's a jerk and also everything around him that happens is sad and awful? There's a lot of really good laughs on this show. Like, I want to be really clear about that when I'm saying that.
Right. No, I understand. And we made it hard on ourselves because you don't want to make him too milquetoast or whatever the word is, or TV funny. I mean, I always see these TV shows with very fast-talking people and likable, you know, edgy, if you will, and you know, in a very watered-down version of life. There are people that are mean. Just go walk the streets. They're never represented. We're trying to represent people in this show that aren't represented on TV. They just aren't. Why can't we stretch out a little bit and at least explore these other avenues? Now, the problem with that, though, Jesse, is you kind of tend to write yourself into a corner. But I think
what's the corner that you write yourself into?
Well, without redemption or without growth of a character, and if he's just mean, you know, this is a serial structure. A serial narrative. So I want him to have growth. I want him to have redemption. But I want him to struggle to find it. I want it to be awkward and clumsy and funny and insightful and heartbreaking as life is. The way that we are also used to TV shows being, I just find so normal and regular and not very creative. And I'm not saying that we have accomplished that whatsoever. I think I'm certainly aware of the fact that certain people are turned off by this show because of its weird structure and what it's, you know, its aim is. But you can't just keep the character mean, is what I'm trying to say, to answer your question. Yes, he is, but I'm hoping to explain why he is. And I think he kind of represents our culture as being kind of angry and mad, and that was a tinge of it too in coming up with the character.
I mean, there's something to be said for a guy who, no matter what, genuinely believes in something. And it seems like Chip Baskett's pretense is sincere, not a pose, that he really wants to do something special, whether or not he has the, you know, the ability or the context, either one.
I mean, all I can do is just agree with that. I mean, I think it's a pretty grounded show emotionally. And given that Chip is kind of this, where we're catching him in a spot in his life where he is this kind of prickly guy, doesn't mean that he's going to stay there. We're just meeting him right now. People are complex. And he's not going to be one note like that, I don't think. I hope. I mean, I don't know what to do with him, to be honest. I mean, they picked it up for a second series, and it's like, oh, God, they did? I mean, didn't they see the show?
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Zach Galifianakis, co-created and stars in the FX series Baskets. I talked to Zach last year. What do you see as the objective of the show?
I think the main thing was to try to do kind of a non-edgy show in a way that was kind of old-fashioned and innocent, that had some dramatic undertones, if you would, but interrupted with really surprising jokes that kind of come out of the blue that aren't expected. But it's a tricky thing to try to pull off, and even going into it, we knew it was hard. It's tricky, and the tone of it was everything. But I think Jonathan Kreisel, the director of it, got the tone that was in our heads. And also Andrew Bird did the music for it, and I think that also, you know, he helped set the tone, you know, through his whistling. He's such a good whistler. So I think we all were on board knowing what we wanted to do, but we also knew that it was a little bit risky to kind of roll out a show like this.
So I was thinking about the last time I interviewed you, which was actually quite a number of years ago now, something almost like 8 or 10, something like that. And it was before you became a movie star, and it made me think about how odd and surprising and amazing it was when you became a movie star. I mean, I don't think even when you got a starring role in a movie, anyone had the expectation, oh, this is going to be when Zach Galifianakis becomes a movie star from here on out. You know, like,
is
the
that
hangover,
your way? Is that your way? That's your polite way of saying this will not last.
No, that's not. I couldn't have been more thrilled. I was like, wow, this guy I really like gets to star in movies. Like, this is fantastic. And I wonder what it was like for you. Like, I don't get the feeling that you know, doing The Hangover was part of a plan to become a movie star. Hmm. I may be wrong. You know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But what was it like for you when that movie became just a extravaganza, whirlwind of, you know, show business power force?
Well, I wasn't good with it. I was... The privacy thing is the thing that just bummed me out. But, I would talk to my mom about it. She was like, well, you know, be careful what you wish for, Zach. I'm like, well, not that I didn't want success. No, I'm not saying that, but I never thought it was ever going to happen. Right. I never would go, man, when this thing really breaks, you better be ready. I mean, never. It's not gonna happen. What was the mindset?
By the time you starred in The Hangover, you had a relatively big television show on VH1 that had not been a success. There was a lot of really funny stuff on it. It was artistic success, but had not been a success for you. And that was kind of in the past, and it looked like, great, I'm going to be a successful stand-up comic, at least from the outside.
Well, that show tanked. And then I just went back to open mics because, well, show business doesn't owe you anything, you know, just because you keep working and you keep doing the thing the initial, you know, that love that you have for performing. Yeah, I just started doing stand-up again after that tanked, and then I got lucky. You know, Todd Phillips, the Hangover director, saw me perform at a club, and then he kept seeing me perform, and I didn't know that. He was just kind of showing up and seeing, and then he asked me an audition, and I did. But then when that happened, if you're not into that kind of world, that whole Hollywood scene, whatever that is, and it's not of any interest to you, and also you're older, and you kind of have more sense to you than be lost in that. It's a shallow existence, that kind of thing, I think. It can bum you out in a weird way. But no one cares, so it's great. You know, The Hangover was cast such a huge wide net to a huge audience that kind of thing can be jarring to a person, I think.
Especially because your character in the movie is so big and silly and
memorable.
People
think you are that.
Yeah.
So they will sit down with you at a table at a restaurant because they think the character would like it. That's also a weird element to deal with because if people are sending you drinks and, you know, thinking they're going to be part of the party scene, which they saw you in the movie. I don't drink anymore, and I'm a pretty normal guy. So, but that stuff doesn't happen anymore. That hangover stuff doesn't. That craziness has died down. Is this NPR?
Yeah.
Can I tell you a story?
Yes.
Okay, so I was listening.
I love this setup.
I was listening to an NPR station in the backdrop. I'm not going to tell what it is, mm-hmm. But they had a film review on of their summer movies, whatever. And one of the movies they were speaking of, I happen to be on. Now, I am not one to run towards good praise, bad praise, but this guy was talking about a movie I was in. I was like, I'm going to listen to this one. It was on NPR. One of the critics says, after reviewing the movie, let's hope this is the end of Zach Galifianakis' career. Then, oh, by the way, hold on, Jesse, I'm not even telling you the important part. I'm wearing a T-shirt of the radio station that I donated money to, and they're insulting me while I'm wearing the shirt. The other critic says, I hope you're right. There you are. Here's my $500 donation. Please send me a T-shirt. Please insult me while I'm wearing it.
Zach, I'm really sorry that you had to find out this way.
Was it you?
About how we feel about you and your career.
Public radio across the board is what you're saying.
Oh, there's an annual conference called the Public Radio Program Directors, PRPD. And we actually had a keynote that was, what do we do about the Zach Galifianakis problem?
Okay. Well, at least it was... Okay, good. So it's organized. Okay, good. All right. Well, yeah, that was gut-wrenching. Only because I was wearing the T-shirt. Had I not been wearing the T-shirt, okay, no big deal.
I'll continue my conversation with Zach Galifianakis after a break. We'll talk about why the creators of Baskets thought Louis Anderson would be the perfect person to play his mom. P.S. They were totally right. He is. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Missing Richard Simmons, a new podcast that follows filmmaker Dan Taberski's search for fitness guru Richard Simmons. It's 3 years since Simmons disappeared, and Dan Taberski wants to know why. He talks to regulars from Simmons' exercise class, as well as fans, former friends, and celebrities, to understand who Simmons is and what happened to him. Subscribe now to Missing Richard Simmons on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. In any given year, there are more than 100,000 albums released. 100,000! That's nearly 2,000 albums a week. We know it's impossible to keep up with that much music, so NPR's All Songs Considered is here to help. Each week, hosts Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton find the best of the best songs for you to fall in love with. Subscribe to All Songs Considered now at npr.org/podcasts. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Zach Galifianakis. He stars in the FX show Baskets. The show's second season is now on FX. I talked to Zach last year. I want to play one more clip from Baskets. So my guest, Zach Galifianakis, plays both Chip Baskets and Chip's twin brother, Dale. And in this scene, Dale is helping their mom, who's played by the stand-up comic Louis Anderson, get ready for a family dinner. And they have two adopted twin brothers who are younger than them and are successful DJs. And they're going to be coming home. And so the mom wants everything to be perfect for their arrival.
Well, that's good. You got that. I got balloons, ribbons, glasses, plates.
One more thing. We need a bigger table. See if you can get something at Rent a Room. You know, something in a chestnut, walnut, espresso. What's the black wood? Black walnut. Oh, that would be beautiful, black walnut.
I'm happy to help out, Mama, but why isn't this circus twerp out here doing anything?
Well, he's practicing. You can see that.
Well, Mama, your medulla oblongata must be squeaky clean because he has your brain so washed. It's a part of the brain.
Look, I watch your girls at the drop of a hat. And I don't know what your wife's telling them, but they don't like me.
Well, you can say what you want about my wife and I, but at least I gave you grandchildren.
Thank you, Dale. And don't forget to get something dark.
So, Zach, how do you manage the tone of you performing as your own twin brother with a Southern accent, a classic Bakersfield Southern accent, and the legendary stand-up comic Louis Anderson playing a woman without any notable elements of camp?
The idea of playing my twin brother was the director, Jonathan, wanted to be that to be a part of the show, one of the characters. I wasn't 100% sure that that was a good idea. But for the show, it was good because Chip is very quiet, and I wanted to play him quiet. And it's just nice to have a kind of a verbose twin brother that's opposite of Chip, and kind of his nemesis in a weird way, is a nice device in the show. And then the lack of camp as far as that character, and also with the Louis Anderson, is Louis is just hired as an actor. I mean, there was no, oh, wouldn't it be neat if we had a guy play a woman? You know, there was nothing. It was just, he popped in our minds because of the way he sounds, and it just seemed to make sense. And when we shot the pilot,
did you know him personally?
Louis Anderson? No.
Yeah.
No, I just knew his work from The Feud.
Yeah, right.
No, I've always liked Louis' stuff, and his, you know, that presence in the show made sense to me. But when we shot the pilot, they put him in makeup and they overwomaned him, if you will, in a stereotypical way. That was not what we wanted to do. It was just like, he's an actor who happens to be playing a woman, and there should be no tongue-in-cheek anywhere, and that's just how we wanted to do it. It's an homage.
I interviewed a couple of years ago Rick Moranis. You know, when he was roughly at the height of his Hollywood success, he lost his wife and just moved to the East Coast to be with his family. And, you know, he worked once every other year or so on offers if they gave him $1 million just to keep, you know. And I wonder, as somebody who became successful and immediately bought a farm in North Carolina, that has appeal to you. And if it does, what is the thing that you think, you know, that has the power for you to keep you from doing that?
From?
Yeah, from just ghosting. Just getting
gone. Is this a request from NPR?
Yeah.
So they ask you to ask me through a question of if I could get out of the business, Jesse.
They didn't ask me to ask you that.
They...
It's literally a term in my contract.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. But to answer, and you can tell the jerks at NPR that the truthful answer is there's more to life than whatever you do for a living. There should be. And no matter what the profession is, unless you're married to your work, and that's lovely. But I have a friend that always, he says, whatever happened to that so-and-so? I'm like, well, maybe they just realized that the business is hard to keep doing it. And, you know, as a kid, you dream of being in it, and then you get into it, and you're like, oh, there's elements of this that are difficult.
So what's the part that you love enough to keep you doing it?
I mean, it sounds really corny, but I think that connection with from at least in stand-up, I know I don't think I could ever stop doing that. That connection with getting people to laugh, I know it sounds so base, but that to me, I think if you broke it all down, I get a real kick out of that. I just do.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It was really nice to get to see you, and I've really been so happy about all the successes that you've had.
Thank you, Jesse.
Zach Galifianakis, he co-created and stars in the FX show Baskets. It airs Thursday nights at 10. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor Michael K. Williams, who broke through on the HBO show The Wire. In this interview from last year, he was talking about his Sundance TV show Hap and Leonard with James Purefoy. The show's since been renewed for a second season. It's about two friends in East Texas, one straight, white, liberal, and badass, one black, conservative, and gay, and badass. Here's a scene with Williams. He's out looking for a car that has $1 million in it. He's doing it with a guy that he really doesn't care for, whose name is Chubbs.
So Trudy says you're a gay. What's that like?
Let's try a version of this where you don't talk.
You don't act like any homosexuals that I know of.
You don't know any homosexuals.
I'm just saying it's just rare to meet someone who's so comfortable in their own skin. I mean, you're like the first gay black man I've ever met.
One more word, I'll be the last gay black man you ever met.
Michael K. Williams, welcome to Bullseye. It's so great to have you on the show.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
You were a club kid when you were a kid, right?
Yeah. I was the one with the loud floral shirt on and, you know, the high top fade. And, you know, he wore his suspenders backwards with these enormously gaudy looking shoes. I was that dude.
When did you start going to clubs? How old were you?
Oh, I was way underage, man. My first like adult club I went to, I had to be somewhere around 16 years old.
What kind of music were you dancing to?
I grew up liking, like, you know, music to dance to. You know, I liked the Bee Gees. I loved the Jackson 5. You know, I grew up with that Philly sound, that gambling huff, you know, that sound, that hustle music, you know, disco, whatever you want to call it. You know, I call it that feel-good music. You know, love is the message. And so I always gravitated towards up-tempo beats and you know, huge lyrics. And, you know, that kind of migrated to what we now know as house music, to my knowledge. So I kind of went that way, you know. And, yeah, that was my thing. That's why I homed in on my dance skills, actually.
When you were, like, a teenager and in your early 20s, like, how many nights a week were you going out?
Oh, well, New York is and always has been a weekday kind of city. So, I mean, like, Tuesdays, Thursdays, you know, you might find a hot spot on a Monday, you know, a Sunday. But, like, Friday and Saturday, we usually gave that to the, you know, as what we refer to as the bridge and tunnelers. You know?
You didn't want to deal with that Jersey City nonsense.
Yeah, you know, shout out to Jersey, Newark.
When did you think that, you know, dancing in a club could be more than just a thing you did a few nights a week for fun and could actually be a job?
Well, I think you're the first person that ever asked me that. One night there was a Heather Hunter, the ex-porn star. She's a very good friend of mine. When I first met her, she was branching out into doing music. And she had a gig at this club in New York called the Sound Factory Bar. And in the 11th hour, her dancers backed out. And she was contracted, you know, to have be on stage a certain amount of time with a certain you know, level of stage performance. And she was freaking out. And she and I had a mutual friend in common. She called him. He called me. And I was like, wait a minute. Heather Hunter, the legendary porn star, wants to get me in my favorite club for free, let me do what I love to do the most on a stage where I don't have to worry about nobody getting in my way, and I'm getting paid. I'm like, where do I sign up? And I got bit by the bug. I loved it. Loved being on stage.
How old were you? I mean, what are we talking about?
26, 20, 25. Well, I got cut on my 25th birthday, and this was definitely after that. So I would have to be somewhere between 26, 27.
I want to play a song that came out when you were right around that age, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about what you remember about it and that time. This is Kim Sims and Too Blind to See It.
Wow.
So tell me about that, Michael.
I'm sorry. Give me a sec. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Excuse me. I saw him, man. That was the first time that, you know, my dream came true. You know what I mean? Like, when Kim hired me to be a dancer, I was homeless. You know what I mean? I remember when I got the call, I was being kicked out. So while I was staying, they wanted me to leave. And I got the call that she wanted me to dance for. And I went to where I was staying. I was packing up my stuff and I turned on the TV. And I remember that was the same night that Mike Jackson, he released a video for Remember the Time. You know what I mean? And he had got all the dancers from New York. And I remember seeing, like, Leslie Siegel and Josie and Stretch and all these young brothers and sisters that I looked up to and I aspired to be. Like, they was working with Michael Jackson. And I was like, one day I'm going to be there. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry. It's just, I haven't heard that song in a while. Just brought back a lot of memories. That's all. Pardon me.
Not at all. Was that the first...
That was my first dance job. That's the first time anybody ever hired me to do what I'm doing now was Kim Sims. That was my first job doing anything in this business. You know what I mean? Anything. You know what I mean? So I'm here today on the strength of that one song. I mean, shout out to Kim Sims, man.
How'd you get the job?
You know what I mean? Through a mutual friend. She had a dancer who was already... her choreographer at the time, his brother from Brooklyn named Chad Brown, he was already working with her, right? And he had kind of recruited me to be like a standby, if you will, you know, like a for case him or his other dancer who he was taking out on the road to do her shows. And, you know, I met her through him, but I was the standby, the backup, the standby, you know, in case one of them couldn't make this show. So for like a couple of months, I was just learning her routines. You know, he was teaching me the routines and, you know, just getting me ready in case we had to make the call, I could just go. And that was, she gave me my shot, man. The call came. Chad couldn't make a show. And he put me on, you know, I was up, gave my shot, and she ended up just keeping me, man.
When that happened, did you feel like a professional?
Yeah, you're damn right I did. I felt like a grown-up. I felt like, you know, I felt like, damn, it's really possible to get paid doing something you love. You know, that wasn't a job. That was my first glimpse into my career, you know. Who'd have thunk it? Me from Brooklyn, from Flatbush, with a career. You know what I mean? That doesn't happen often.
You had done some kind of classic New York actor work earlier in your career, like being on Law and Order and stuff. But from what I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you weren't really working when you went out for Omar. Is that true?
Yes, sir. My mom's had a, my mom, thank God for her, man. Shout out to Lady P, man, Big Mama. My mother opened up a daycare in the projects where we lived, and she was able to offer me a job. So I took it, and I prided myself as her administrative assistant. You know, she was old school. She still had her ledger book and whatnot, and she wrote everything down. I said, it's 2000. We got to get this computers going on in here. So I did all of that for her, and you know, with a lot of help. And we implicated a free lunch program in the daycare. And I would say all that took up all of 2000 and kept me occupied. And for most of 2001, up until around October or so of 2001, I was sitting in my apartment, and how we do in the hood, you know, we put the TV on, but it's muted. You play music, and then, you know, see some spades, dominoes, you know, beer, weed, whatever going on, but chilling, wintertime. And that was one of the things in my apartment, one of the nights in my crib. And I was there with Ruck, who just passed, man. Shout out to my brother Ruck, boot camp, man. He was there, me and him and my cousin. And the episode that I was on, Sopranos, came on TV. So I was like, okay, there's something wrong with this picture. I'm here on the television, and I'm here in the room. I said, what's happening here? It was like kind of like an out-of-body experience. And so I went to my mom. I said, look, I'm going to give this entertainment one more shot, right, Mom? I said, if it don't work, it's me and you, baby. We changing diapers, right? So I said, listen, see what you need. I said, I need a loan. Give me 10 grand. She gave it to me. Reluctantly, but she gave it to me. And I put together this new, whole new reel, because it was the emancipation, you know what I mean? My emancipation, the comeback, you know what I mean? I'm back on the block. So I got a whole new reel, a whole new headshot. I bought a computer, because back in them days, it was before Apple. You had to go to the computer show at Queens Community College and build your computer. That's how we did it back in the day. And so, boom. And I put together this real gaudy package, and I put a hit list of 10 people who I was going to send this package to, like the reel, the headshot. I went, my homeboy, his mom's worked for Tiffany's, so I went and got all these Tiffany pens and Tiffany boxes, and I sprayed the tissue with Tiffany cologne, just going all out. And I mailed it to 10 people, Kedar, forget his last name right now, he's a music guy, Jimmy Roseman, a.k.a. Jimmy Hinchman, Shaquem Kapoor, Jackie Brown Carmen. These are some of the names that's on my list. I sent them out for Christmas presents, right? I said, you know what, Mike, it's Christmas. Let it marinate. I said, I watched my clock. Right around January 10th, 14th, I should be getting some calls like, oh, my God, we want to see you. Man, here we are in March. My mom's just beating on my door. Where's my money? I'm like, yeah, man, I kind of slipped into a darkness. I got a little depressed. This was, you know, post. I never really dealt with the 9/11 thing. I was having some stress issues with that, and, you know, just being in the projects, you know, feeling unfulfilled, and I slipped into a little slight depression. And so, you know, that's where I was at when I got a call from Alexa Fogel. Thank God for her. She scoured the streets in New York to find me, because apparently she did not see my awesome package. You know what I mean? But she found me.
You sent it to Kedar Massenburg, the guy that ran Motown Records.
I was desperate.
You were trying to be the next Erykah Badu.
Erykah Badu or D'Angelo somebody. Come get me. But, yeah, you know, Alexa Fogel found me. She found me in my despair. And she asked me to come meet this guy named Omar Devone Little.
It seems like it wasn't a particularly smooth journey the next 5-10 years of your career, though.
You know, I think I've been so fortunate and blessed. I think I've had a very, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I got nothing to complain about, nothing at all. You know, in the short amount of time I've been in this business, you know, especially as an actor, the amount of success I've achieved, the level of people I've been blessed to work with and learn from has been truly like a dream come true. You know, I mean, I got to remember, I only started acting. My first big job was The Wire. That was just 2002 we started. You know, I started on The Wire, you know, for, I'm talking with someone who never acted before, never had any dreams to act, never went to school to act, you know, and I got given this opportunity, you know, and grace of God, man, I was able to turn it into something, you know, that I could really, you know, do good with.
I'll finish my conversation with Michael K. Williams after a break. He'll tell us why he's so proud to have played Omar on The Wire. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Green Chef, the easy, organic way to cook. Green Chef's organic meal kits deliver fresh ingredients and healthy recipes right to you. Feel great about the food you cook and where it comes from. No planning, no shopping, only delicious dinners in no time. Choose the plan for you with options like vegan, paleo, gluten-free, and more. Go to greenchef.com/bullseye to get $50 off. Green Chef, deliciously simple. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actor Michael K. Williams, who you might know from HBO shows like The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, and The Night Of. He also co-stars in Sundance TV's Hap and Leonard.
Did you have a point in your career where, especially working mostly as a dancer, you realized that you were going to have to figure something out because, you know, you started as a dancer as professionally in your mid-20s. Which is already
which
on,
is late.
Yeah, which is already like on the old late side. Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of professional. There's not a lot of professional, especially you know, street dancers or urban dancers into their 30s. You know,
man, listen. Shout out to the old heads, man. The old school broom still know the corners. You know what I mean? Shout out to my old school dancers, man. My boogies. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's you know when I knew I had to make a shift was, you know, when I started coming onto the scene, you know, I had the scar on my face. And I went from, you know, Mike Williams, who? Come on, dude with the scar on his face. Oh, yeah. I will admit I played that card for like about a whole 5 minutes. And that got real old hat to me. And I said, well, if I'm getting tired of being referred to as the guy with the scar, I said, it's going to be a matter of time before they start referring to me as the guy with the scar. I said, I'm in the building, but if I want to stay in the building, I need to bring some substance to this. And that's when I got blessed to be introduced to the underground, off-Broadway world of New York City through my brother, Ray Thomas, again from Philly. He brought me to La Mama, and where I met Ellen Stewart, God bless the dead, and they put me in this play, and that's where I learned how to create character and layers, and you know what is the method technique, what is the Meisner technique, and you know, and then I got with my theater company, which I'm still with today, Theater for a New Generation, under Mel Williams' tutelage. When he put his hands on me, it was a wrap. After that, I was going in these auditions, just knocking them down, and you know, it was that. That gave me the substance and, you know, to let the scar go. It's not about my scar. I'm not here because of that, you know, today.
Was it scary to be as emotionally present and open as acting requires, or was that something that came comfortably to you?
Dude, you just played a pop house song and I cried like a baby just now. I think we know the answer to that. I'm a marshmallow here. I can't run that fast. You know, but, you know, that's where my strength lies. You know, is you know, being sensitive and vulnerable, you know, that's who I am. You know, and ironically, the more I allow myself to be that and to allow people to see that is where my strength comes from, you know.
Well, let's hear a clip of you playing Omar on The Wire. Omar was a stick-up artist who stuck up drug dealers. Sort of universally some combination of respected and feared in the neighborhood in which he lived, both because he had that code of only sticking up drug dealers and because he was the only person foolish slash terrifying enough to go around sticking up drug dealers. Here he is in season two of the show, testifying in court, and he's just been sworn in.
State your name for the record.
Omar Devone Little.
Mr. Little, how old are you?
About 29, thereabout.
And where do you live?
No place in particular, ma'am.
You're homeless?
In the wind, so to speak.
And what is your occupation?
Occupation?
What exactly do you do for a living, Mr. Little?
I rip and run.
You...
I robs drug dealers.
And exactly how long has this been your occupation, Mr. Little?
Oh, I don't know exactly. I venture to say maybe about 8 or 9 years.
Mr. Little, how does a man rob drug dealers for 8 or 9 years and live to tell about it?
Day to time, I suppose. Shout out to David Simon, man. Nina Noble, Ed Burns.
This job was so important to you because it was such a breakthrough. I mean, it was the difference between you working for your mom in the daycare center changing diapers and you being a real professional actor making a living from being on screen. That must have really upped the stakes, you know, compared to some of the acting vets who could have felt confident that this would just lead to their next thing.
Yeah, I came on The Wire extremely excited and very, very passionate to do the best job that I can possibly do. And I was just so in awe of the people they had already had on the cast, you know, starting first with Wendell Pierce and Sonya Song. You know, I had just seen, I was like obsessed with her performance opposite Saul Williams in this movie called Slam. You know, so see her and, you know, Wood Harris. I was like, oh, my God. You know what I mean? I bought my A game, my A-plus game, actually. And I dug as hard as I could to find Omar. And I never stopped, like, you know, going deeper with him. It was always, I can go deeper. What other nuances can I find? What other layers can I add on? You know, it was always, I attacked that like a dog that hadn't been fed in so long, you know what I mean? And I had a lot of support. That was truly an ensemble.
I want to play another great Omar scene from The Wire. So Omar and his boyfriend Brandon are on, they're part of this stick-up crew, and they're about to go meet up with another dude called Bailey. Who's in the crew in this scene. This is from the fifth episode of the first season. And they're packing up guns. And there's a little bit of profanity in this that we will bleep for the radio, but just, you know, be prepared, America.
Hey, why you always got to talk like that, man?
What?
This and that.
I give it up. I lose half of what I mean to say.
Don't nobody want to hear them dirty words, man. Especially coming from such a beautiful mouth.
Wait for Billy.
Early bird catch the worm, dog.
I heard that kiss wasn't in the script.
No, it was not. there was a lot of newness on the set of The Wire. You know, a lot of, you know, first-timers like myself. And, you know, it was just so many characters and personalities and storylines to manage.
you know, on a new show with minimal, you know, we had minimal dollars. They didn't roll out the red carpet for us over there in Baltimore on The Wire. So we had to make do, and there was no room for error. The directors that would come in would keep things kind of like, you know, just, you know, trying to just get through it, man, because there was so much to manage. And I was like, you know, I forget which episode I had. I was like, wait a minute. I said, okay, now I signed up to play a gay character, right? I know that I don't have to act feminine. I said, but, you know, I think it should be some more happening here. It should be like, we're doing a real show here, right? So we got to keep it popping. So I went to my co-star at the time, Michael. His name is also Michael, who played Brandon. And I was like, yo, Mike, I think we got to step it up, man. I said, all they got us doing is holding hands and rubbing lips and playing in your hair. I said, we got to, like, you know, saying, bring it. I said, you know what I mean? He says, what do you suggest we do? I said, yo, I think we should lock lips in this scene right here. He said, all right, when are you going to do it? And I started to tell him. He said, don't tell me, because I might freeze up when it's coming. Just pull in for it. Just go for it. I said, I got you, right? And I forgot what's my man's name who was directing that episode. Oh, man, I'm getting old. Johnson.
Clark Johnson.
Clark Johnson was directing this particular episode. So he called us in for rehearsal. You know, he's like, yeah, run the lines. And he was still giving some direction, doing something with the lighting or with the camera or whatever. And he heard the kiss. He turned around, looked at us. He said, whoa, stop the work. He said, run that scene again. Did it. And kissed again. He's like, he looked at me. He looked at, read the script. He said, y'all put that in there? I said, yeah, we put that in there. Nodded his head. He said, brave. And I know from that point on, they started calling Michael K. Williams to the set no more. You know what I mean? I set the tone, kind of, you know, set it up.
You know, there are a few characters that people are more fascinated by or identify with more on The Wire. And there are not a lot of shows, there are still not a lot of shows that treat the kind of situations and people that are on The Wire with the respect that The Wire did. And I think it really was, you know, it was really resonant for a lot of people for that reason. And so your character was the baddest of the bad on this show, and also really sweet and, you know, touching character, and was also gay. And, you know, you were dancing to house music in 1988. I imagine that you were reasonably comfortable with the idea of there being lots of different kinds of gay guys. But when you were just walking home in Brooklyn or something and somebody came up to you and said, oh, man, are you Omar? It must have been a trip to connect with people who you were meeting that maybe didn't have that experience or weren't comfortable having that experience, for them to feel like they got to know Omar and that you get to have that exchange with them and almost be an ambassador. You know what I mean?
Wow, ambassador. That's ambassador. That's a strong word. But, you know, I definitely, you know, I've been approached a few times and with warm words about breaking a certain stereotype of black gay men in Hollywood, or just gay men, period, in Hollywood, always being one way, which was feminine, you know, and, you know, or out, or, you know, so obvious, whereas that's not the entire gay community. So, I got approached a few times and, like, got nodded, like, you know, good looking, you know, good portrayal of the character, you know. But I would say my proudest moment of having anything to do with anything in that perspective was when I heard from Jay-Z's camp that allegedly my portrayal of Omar had given him some sort of courage, if you will, to come out publicly and speak for marriage equality. You know what I mean? And I thought that, you know, he didn't have to put that out there. So I heard through his camp that you know, that was part of his decision, included in part of his decision making to come publicly with that, and that humbled me a lot.
We're just about out of time, Michael, but I want to ask you about one slightly frivolous thing. So you and a couple of your co-stars from The Wire are in one of my favorite music videos for one of my favorite songs ever. Cool. Which is What We Do by Freeway.
You know, dude, you're shocking me today. You just keep coming with these, like, little, who are you, dude? You all over the place. I got a lot of respect for you, man. That's dope.
I know that I remember when that song came out, I was a fan of The Wire, and seeing that video, you know, on like on 106 in Park or something like that, it was like, oh man, other people watch The Wire. Like, this whole time I thought it was just me, but it turns out it's me and maybe Jay-Z and Freeway and Beanie Siegel.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I realized that someone else was, people were actually watching the show. I was going in the city to meet a friend of mine, and I had the radio on at Hot 97, and you know, it was Friday mix, you know, hip hop. And what's the one, the dude from the G Unit camp? I think it was Yayo, Tony Yayo. He was spitting live on the radio, and the dude said, I jump out the car with the Ruger on fire. Something, 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 like Omar on the Wire. When I tell you I heard that, I almost crashed on the Brooklyn Bridge. I was like, yo, yo. Man, yeah. I was like, okay, I guess people are watching. Yeah.
Well, Michael K. Williams, I sure appreciate you coming on Bullseye. You're welcome here at any time. It was just a pleasure.
Thank you, man.
Michael K. Williams from last year. The Sundance show Hap and Leonard, which he co-stars in, is a ton of fun. It got picked up for a second season. Really great show. He's really great on it. Every week we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. The Gravediggers were a rap group dedicated to death. They were a super group, really. Prince Paul, The RZA, Fruquan, and Poetic. For the purposes of the group, they changed their names to The Undertaker, The Gatekeeper, The Resurrector, and The Grim Reaper. In the early 90s, when gangster rap was cresting, they didn't rap about killing. They rapped about death as a metaphor. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't get dark. Here's Poetic, a.k.a. The Grim Reaper.
I force my teeth on the gospel tracks. I'm not an apostle, but I bring the axe to your back. I chew and attack like crest on plaque. After that, your world is black. You drop into a hole. Your mold separates from your soul. Behold, the grave diggers told you beware, but you didn't listen. So now we appear. Eardrums glisten.
The grave diggers were obsessed with the resurrection of the mentally dead. Sometimes they were scary, sometimes funny, sometimes beautiful. Their first single, 1-800-SUICIDE, is basically a list of absurdly intense ways to end your life. Or, as the Gravediggers saw it, end your ignorance.
Hey, you little rich kid, what's your beef? Come and tell the Grim Reaper all of your grief. You ask for a bend and you only got a cheat. Your pops got ends, but yo, he's mad cheap. Maybe you're a bastard child, you think. Mom and dad are white and you're dark as ink. Maybe you're Sicilian. Lasagna and the pizza man. Now you stand on the grave digger lot. You're singing the blues about the rough life you got. Not, you don't wanna live no more. I guess you're really ready for the graveyard tour. When you get home, just seal up your windows and your doors. Turn the oven on high for about 4 hours. Light you a blunt, kiss your ass goodbye. You gas yourself, cause it's a suicide.
By the time the early 2000s rolled around, a second album had been less successful than the first. Honestly, the first wasn't that huge. Prince Paul and the RZA had left the group. Things had been dormant for half a decade. And there had been one huge change. In 1999, Poetic, the Grim Reaper, was diagnosed with cancer. The doctor said he had 3 months to live. He fought hard. It bought him a few years. But Poetic must have thought some of that time about how this metaphor he'd played with the gravediggers, was becoming terrifyingly real. His last verse on record is one of the few hip-hop songs that's moved me to tears. You hear a lot about death as an abstract in songs, but death wasn't abstract to Poetic. It was present and absolute. The verse is from a song called One Life, and it's a clear-eyed embrace of the simple physical pain of dying and of the terror that comes with not knowing what'll happen after your last breath. In a genre that usually prefers mythology to reality, it's almost too real.
How
paralyzed on the bathroom floor by pain. Last month I endured, but now I can't ignore. Feels like railroad spikes being stuck in my liver. Am I dying? Eyes crying, body starting to shiver. Crawl upstairs from the basement, calling my sister. Dawn, help me, I ain't feeling too healthy. Stomach walls burning, head spinning and turning, waiting for the EMS 3:10 in the morning. Rush me to emergency, screaming like a newborn. The pain's too strong, maybe my soul's trying to move on. They hooked me to the IV, put me through some x-rays, gave me Demerol to kill the pain, that was the next phase. Early the next day in a hospital room, moms and pops in the room, three or four docs in the room. Test results suggest your colon in your liver, it's so cancerous. You got 3 months left, death is playing chess. Ever since then, my strength is the most high, my fam and close friends. The last F been set free, bless me with a verse. Staying healthy comes first, look at me, things could be worse.
When I'm wrestling with the everyday, I sometimes find myself thinking of Poetic. Just trying to get up and get to the phone so he can call his sister. I think about his life, over at about my age now. And it strengthens my resolve to do what I can with what I have. Poetic, I never knew you, but I thank you. That's my outshot. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Our show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson, with help from Christian Duenas, production fellows at MaximumFun.org, Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer, Laura Swisher. All our interstitial music is provided to us by Dan Wally. You can actually download on a pay-what-you-will basis a lot of the music that he made for Bullseye. Look for it on Bandcamp. Our theme music was recorded by the Go Team. They gave it to us along with their label, Memphis Industries. Our thanks go to the Go Team. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And while you're there, check out Pop Rocket. It's Bullseye's sister show. Every Wednesday, Pop Rocket brings you a fascinating and funny conversation about stuff like the Oscars, TV reboots, classic albums, basically everything we love to love in pop culture. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.